south of the border, down Mexico way. That's where I fell in love when the stars above came out to play. And now as I wander, my thoughts ever stray.
Hi, everybody. I'm Johnny Mueller, and you're listening to The Expat Files, Living in Latin America, the show that tells you what it's really like to live, work, play, and or retire in Latin America. I tell it just like it is, so let's get started.
Okay, before I start today, again, I'd like to announce that my Expat Wisdom Insiders Seminar, the one that so many people have been asking for details about, like I said, again, it's going to be held in Central America. That's Sunday, June 23rd through Friday, June 28th. So, yes, it's been all firmed up, and you'll be able to read all about it and get all the details if you go to my website, expatwisdom.com, and click on the seminar link. And that link should be up on the website by Monday, April 15th, or hopefully even sooner. So do check it out. And remember, I'm only allowing 24 people on the trip. So it'll be nothing like one of those big cattle call seminars with hundreds of people, you know, like those big international mega seminars that are held in gringo-saturated tourist spots like Panama, Costa Rica, or Cancun, or Playa del Carmen, you know, where there's hundreds of people and there's basically no personal touch at all. And you know, it beats me. I just don't get it. Why do these big companies even try to put on their seminars at these big gringo-saturated, first-world expensive tourist sites? Those are the places you've got no gringo advantage at all. Exactly where you don't want to come down and live as an expat. That's what my whole show is about, advising against doing that. Unless, of course, you don't mind first world expensive and hanging with gringos 24/7. So, if it's just about the weather and the sun and fun, why don't you just move to Florida or Arizona? But you know by now that's not where I'm coming from. You know what my religion is. Stay and live off the tourist trail where you've got that huge gringo advantage working for you. Because when you're on the tourist trail, all you really are to the locals is a big dollar sign. So, will somebody please tell me why these big international seminar guys stick you right in the middle of that? And then, to add insult to injury, they try to sell you a chunk of real estate there. Even though you're right in the middle of a real estate bubble that no one ever seems to mention. Except yours truly. So let me get this straight. They advise that you settle in a country where you're just a dollar sign to the locals. A place where your gringo advantage has long since vanished. And those great real estate opportunities they direct you to are no cheaper than what you'd pay if you were buying the same kind of thing up in the States. Oh, and let's not forget the first world style taxes that they hit you with in those countries too. And though they may not be able to copy the US style Big Brother system because they just don't have the resources, they certainly have copied the US tax structure. So, will somebody please explain to me what's going on here? Okay, I guess I've beat up on those guys enough. But to their credit, at least they're offering first world people a way to get out. Which is perfectly fine for expat wannabes who want to land down here in a soft way. A soft landing, you know, where they can hit the ground running where there have already been a ton of gringos who've paved the way. Nothing wrong with that. At least you've got that option. Now, as for my upcoming event, like I said, I'm only allotting 24 spots off the gringo tourist trail, of course. And I still get emails from people asking me why only 24 people. There's really two very good reasons for that. One of the places that we visit has some very beautiful Spanish colonial boutique hotels, some of them 200 and 300 years old. Restored to first world standards, of course. But you see, almost none of these very cool hotels has more than 30 rooms. And no way am I going to split up my group, since that's part of the immersion experience. All of us hanging together, doing the same things, sharing the same experiences, 24/7. So I have to have rooms for 24 people and my expat wisdom staff and me, of course. All at the same hotels. And the other reason why I can only accommodate 24 people is because when we're out on the road, on the boots on the ground part of the seminar, when we're visiting hospitals and medical complexes and factories and IT centers and checking out the real estate bubble and visiting businesses and things, well, some of those factories and business outfits are owned by personal longtime friends of mine who'd never for a second permit an outsider or any group of outsiders to step foot in their establishment. What I mean is, they don't give tours, but they are opening their doors as a favor to me. And I'd never want to wear out my welcome or abuse the privilege by showing up with a big, unwieldy group of people. And that would be the end of my VIP tours. And that in itself should tell you about the big seminars that are put on in Costa Rica and Panama and Playa del Carmen and stuff. They could never give you that hands-on, personal VIP treatment. I don't see how they could walk you individually through anything at all. Now, imagine over 100 people at a seminar with boots on the ground. Now, you'd be talking about a minimum of 3 or 4 school buses filled with people, showing up at some small businessman's doorstep. The logistics of that would just be impossible. But it's something I can easily pull off with only 24 people. And that's just what we do. We stop to visit some of my personal expat gringo friends at their factories and businesses. Now, these are great examples of expat rags-to-riches stories. These guys came down here some years ago with no Spanish, without any contacts at all, and with a very small amount of money. Enough to start a small business down here, but not nearly enough to do a business in the States, which is one big reason they came down here in the first place. And believe it or not, these guys did not come down to Latin America with any kind of business plan. Things just kind of happened for them as they stumbled along. So if you do come down to my next seminar, you can hear them tell their own stories and you can ask them as many questions as you like. And you can't put a price on that kind of information, can you? Anyway, that's just a little of what my seminar offers and part of what it's all about. So go to expatwisdom.com and click on the seminar link. Anyway, back to the show. The majority of emails that I get are coming from people who want to know about doing business down here in Latin America. Usually, they have a few ideas themselves, but mainly they want to know if I have any inside information on ideas about businesses that I can give them. And I'll tell you, expats down here with boots on the ground, they see business ideas all the time. And like expat Eddie says, sometimes it's like going to a restaurant with way too much on the menu. You can't decide what to pick. We should all have that problem, right? Up in the States, unless you got a ton of dough, you can forget about that. Well, just come down here and you'll see for yourself. The fact is, I do get a lot of emails from expat wannabes up north who are sitting on the fence. They want to come down in the worst way, but they're terribly worried about making the move. They have a cloud hanging over them, basically a nagging fear of failure. And it's not about the culture clash or not knowing any Spanish. It's about the money, or the lack of money. And they think if they come down here with 5 or 10 grand, because it's all they've got, once it's run out, they're SOL. And you know, I even get emails like that from people who've got 300 or even 500 grand stashed in the bank up north or that much in assets. Believe it or not, even some of those guys have a fear of failure. They too are worried about crashing and burning when they get down here. And you know, I think it boils down to the way us first world Americans are brought up. We are brought up with all these safety nets. Our parents, our relatives, the government, Social Security, unemployment insurance and health insurance, even welfare. And you're thinking when you get down here, well, there's none of that. Suddenly it's you taking care of yourself, nobody else. It's all on your shoulders. But what you're forgetting is that the logical part of your brain keeps telling you how expensive and difficult it is to start a business and to live comfortably up north because that's what you're accustomed to. That's your point of reference and all you've ever known. And just me telling you you have to change that mindset completely when you get down here isn't going to make it so. But I can offer some neat examples along the way that should lessen your fears quite a bit. So let me start right now with something I think you really have to know. And if this doesn't put you scaredy cats in a nice comfort zone, I don't know what will. So here goes. As much as I poo-poo the idea of opening a restaurant, a bar, or a disco, or a bed and breakfast, or a mom-and-pop hotel, there are some obvious exceptions, and in fact, in some cases, it could be a very good idea. Now, normally, there's one big reason why I advise against starting businesses like the ones I just mentioned. And that's because there's just so much competition. And I say that, even if your competition is strictly lame, local, Latin competition. And the worst of all business scenarios is if you're going up against gringo or first world competition. Then you're just asking to get sucker punched. So that's why my best advice is that you should be looking to fill a niche. Like, for example, if there's an excess demand somewhere or an obvious shortage. And a lot of gringos, you know, end up being the only game in town or the only game in the neighborhood, which is ideal, right? But let me give you an idea for a surefire thing that kind of goes against my basic business instincts, but this is one of those exceptions to the rule. So don't laugh at me when I say that there's a great shortage of what we might call the average American Chinese restaurant. And I know that sounds like an oxymoron, but hear me out on this. Now, sure, all throughout Latin America, there's a zillion Chinese restaurants. They're everywhere. just like pizza joints. But let me tell you, there's only two kind of Chinese restaurants. The 99% that are absolutely dark, dank, and foreboding when you go inside. Not to mention, totally unsanitary, with kitchens that look like the inside of a dumpster and bathrooms, well, I don't want to gross you out, so for now, let's skip that. But still, these places are absolutely thriving, and some of them doing gangbusters, balls to the wall. Why? Number one, because Latins don't know any different, and number two, they're very cheap. Then you got that other 1% or less of the very high-end Chinese restaurants, practically gourmet. And you'll generally only find those in high-end shopping centers or in the very wealthy commercial sections of medium and large Latin American cities. And those places can be quite classy and are generally very clean, but you're going to pay easily double or triple what you'd pay at your standard Chinese restaurant. So in fact, when you go into one of those places, you never see the average Latin guy. You only see the upscale crowd with nice cars, often with a gaggle of bodyguards out in the parking lot. Can you believe it? Bodyguards and Range Rovers in Chinese restaurant parking lots? Don't laugh. Down here you see the same thing in the IHOP parking lot. Only in Latin America, huh? So if by chance you decide to open your own Chinese restaurant, that'll be your competition. Those tens of thousands of dirt cheap, unsanitary, scummy ones? And those very rarefied high-end Chinese restaurants that, basically, you and I would probably skip altogether too. So what I'm telling you is there's a huge vacant gap in the middle. So if you like the restaurant business, there's your niche. There are just no middle-of-the-road Chinese restaurants like we know so well up in the States. It's that American version of a Chinese restaurant that just doesn't exist down here. And really, it's a no-brainer. So all you have to do basically is copy your good old neighborhood Chinese restaurant. If you were to open up a clone restaurant like that, anywhere down here in Latin America, and I tell you, in no time the word will get around and you might even be famous. And let me tell you a few more things that your competition doesn't have. That is, besides the obvious. Like, for example, basic hygiene and cleanliness. Well, how about decent bathrooms where the water actually works and they have real paper towels and even toilet paper? Sometimes. Well, one more thing they almost never have is decent lighting. So unless it's a bright day and the sun's shining through the window, you feel like you're eating in a dungeon. And usually when they do have lights, 25% of them are burnt out or just plain broken. But that's the status quo in practically every restaurant in Latin America. Except, of course, restaurants owned by gringos and U.S. franchises that have come down. And as much as I hate American fast food joints, one good thing is that places like Wendy's and McDonald's and such have to hold to first world hygiene standards or lose the franchise. And in that case, you know who's doing the inspections, don't you? The management, not the local government, because, well, the local Latin Health and Safety Bureau never actually get around to doing their job. And every little Latin city and town really does have a bureau like that somewhere. They're in the phone book, but try getting through. Those guys are perpetually asleep at the wheel or just don't have gas for the company car. If they were on the job, those Chinese restaurants I've been talking about would be shut down in a New York minute. But they aren't, so there's your niche. Anyway, let's concentrate on why if you opened up a Chinese restaurant, or if you just leased or bought out a dumpy one that was available, if you just cleaned the place up, fixed the lighting and the broken window panes, and painted the place and plugged the roof leaks, you'd be way ahead of the game and off to a running start. Oh yeah, and before we get too far with this, let's talk about signage for a second. Now, of the hundreds of Chinese restaurants I've seen in Latin America, I can't think of one example where the outside sign or the parking lot lettering wasn't either broke, damaged, corroded, rusted, or simply falling down. Which gives you a good idea what kind of tender, loving care is taken when they prepare your Kung Pao chicken. Okay, aside from the miserable signage, it turns out that only about 1 in 200 Chinese restaurants has fortune cookies. Say what? A Chinese restaurant without fortune cookies? What planet are you talking about, Johnny? And of course, what you didn't know is that fortune cookies were invented in California in 1918. But no matter, they're part of the experience, right? So then you might ask, why don't restaurant owners buy their fortune cookies at the Chinese restaurant supply? There's plenty of those places around. I've been in a few. In fact, it was expat Eddie that dragged me through a few of those places. And they do have fortune cookies there. I've seen them. But turns out, restaurants almost never buy them. Why? Because, for one, the owners tell me they're too expensive. Not to mention, they don't have fortune cookies with the message printed in Spanish, only in English. So what good does that do, right? Now, there's another niche for you, making fortune cookies with Spanish sayings in them. But maybe not. Like one of these Chinese restaurant supply owners told me, if you laid a couple of fortune cookies on a table in a Chinese restaurant, the clients would just gulp them down. If the paper with the little fortune on it got stuck in their teeth, well, they'd spit it out. They have no idea there's a fortune inside. Fortune cookies are not in their vocabulary. So if you offered fortune cookies at your restaurant, which you would, because that's part of the experience, you'd have to train your clients a bit. Maybe have a little fortune cookie legend printed on the menu or on the placemats or something. And like expat Eddie says, and he's a guy that really knows the restaurant business, he says, why not call your restaurant the fortune cookie? I mean, that says it all, right? And use a fortune cookie logo, too. Okay, nothing mind-bending or earth-shattering about that info. In fact, to a first-world business mind, it's pretty damn lame. But you can see how the ideas start flowing, but only when you're down here actually looking at things. I mean, when you're up there in Cleveland, who's thinking, Chinese restaurants, good investment for Latin America? Yeah, right. But there's more. There's another, what we'd call traditional thing, that 99.9% of all Latin American Chinese restaurants never do and have never considered. They don't and never seem to use the traditional Chinese white carryout box. Instead, they just shove the food in a flimsy, ugly plastic tub. They don't use that signature box that we've all come to know and love. That's part of our Chinese restaurant experience. And you might wonder just why they aren't available down here. Another pseudo-Chinese made-in-America invention, maybe? Who knows? So basically, when you sneak into someone's fridge, you never see any of those things in there, which is kind of a letdown. So what I'm saying is there are at least 101 things that are wrong with every Chinese restaurant down here in Latin America, which means there's a big niche just waiting to get filled. And you know, I never thought in a million years I'd be urging anyone to open a Chinese restaurant down here. But you see, a long time ago, I just quit going to Chinese restaurants down here. I quit doing that years ago. I just got sick way too many times. Even after I switched to simply vegetarian fried rice, even without the usual beef or chicken or cat, whatever they put in it. A hell of a lot of gringos still get sick at Chinese restaurants. I mean, after looking at the kitchens and the bathrooms in those places, you'd be nuts to want to eat there. But all green gringos and short-term expats do occasionally order Chinese and occasionally get very sick. Talk about a bacterial cross-contamination paradise. Did I just say that? Anyway, it's not that the food doesn't look good and sometimes even taste real good. So does the food that people cook outside on the street in their kiosks. But eventually, we learn, you just have to be knocked off your feet for 2 or 3 days to figure out that you never want to eat that stuff again. But low-budget, unsanitary crap like that are still favorites with cheap gringos and backpackers. They just keep getting sick and never learn. Now, of course, the locals are eating that stuff all the time. In between licking their fingers and touching doorknobs and chairs and counting their money and licking their fingers again and picking their noses and touching their hair and petting their mangy dogs and stuff, and you wonder, why aren't they getting sick? Well, you know what? They've got a lot more resistance against it than we do, but they still suffer. That's why anytime you walk up to one of those hole-in-the-wall drug stores, right next to the cash register, you will usually see a little box or plastic bottle or blister packs of this stuff called tinidazole or tinidazole, and a few other drugs in the same family, too. And these are your all-purpose Latin American anti-amoebic dysentery drugs. And why do you think they've got a supply of these right next to the cash register? Because amoebas are always on the menu down here. And I gotta admit, that stuff works. Years ago when I first came down, gringo backpackers and stuff would say, take this or that antibiotic, and sometimes it worked and sometimes it didn't. But I can tell you, nothing knocks out amoebic dysentery like the stuff the local pharmacy has right at the cash register. And you only take 2 pills a day for 3 days. The problem is, from what a first world doctor told me, that stuff's basically unobtainable or even illegal up in the States. Too many side effects, he says. Yeah, right. The side effect is that there's no money to be made by the pharmaceutical company, since a whole course of treatment is like $1.50. So anyway, I'm no big fan of pills or pharmaceuticals or anything, but for sure, there are some time-tested medicines they use down here in Latin America that really work. But I was talking about the real shortage of good Chinese restaurants down here now, wasn't I? Off the tourist trail, that is. So let's talk about atmosphere. basically, the ambiance sucks. Or I should say, there is no ambiance. I mean, if you want to listen to throbbing Latin disco music or watch the latest soccer match at full volume, just go to your average Latin Chinese restaurant. And I'll never forget one Chinese restaurant I went to that played Christian music with the Latin version of the 700 Club blasting away on the big screen TV. I wonder what Confucius say about that. Oh, and of course, they do have Thai and Korean and Japanese restaurants here too, but it's pretty much the same. You either have low-end, hole-in-the-wall dumps that should be distributing amoeba medicine along with the bill, and a few very nice, even sometimes spectacular, high-end, fashionable cosmopolitan joints. And you sure don't want to compete with those guys because they've already got the niche. Now, unfortunately, for expat wannabes, there's always someone in the family, the wife or the husband, who wants to start a bar, a disco, a bed and breakfast, or a small mom-and-pop hotel in some tropical paradise in Latin America, which are all pretty tough nuts to crack, and they really are a lot of work. But even worse, when your grand scheme is to come down and open up a restaurant, well, you're just asking for a kick in the teeth. But don't get me wrong, I get how it happens. You take a vacation to Cancun or Costa Rica, and you end up at a nice little quaint restaurant owned and operated by expats, and you say, man, this is what I want to do when I'm semi-retired. But little did you know what that nice expat couple suffered through to get there. And you know, I still get emails from a lot of expat wannabes, especially women, who say their hobby is cooking and they've got some great recipes, and their dream is to open up a restaurant. All they need is a little place, maybe 8 or 10 tables, in a small tourist town or on the fringe of a tourist town, where the rent is cheap and they can live in a little apartment upstairs. But you know, the fact is, being a good cook at home for the family and having a few recipes is a lot different than owning and operating your own restaurant. Fact is, I remember when I lived back up in the States many years ago, one of the best compliments you could pay a woman was to say to her after dinner, that food was really great, you should start your own restaurant. And then of course the husband chimes in, yeah, she's a great cook all right, everyone says the same thing. And I keep telling her we should retire early, go down to Costa Rica and do it. But I know no matter what I say here, I'm still going to get emails from people saying they want to start a restaurant and where's the best place to put one. Now, here's the real irony. You're not going to believe this, but after telling you it's nuts to open up a restaurant, unless you find a great niche like expat Eddie did, or open a Chinese restaurant like in the States. Well, guess who's got a really great idea for a niche restaurant? Yours truly, of course. And I'm not going to tell you what it is either. But if I ever do it and it takes off, I'll hook you up with a franchise. But it's also good to remember, in spite of the warnings you've heard from me, labor, rent, and food are so cheap down here compared to the first world that your startup and operation costs will be ridiculously low. So even if your restaurant was a bad idea, you could operate it a good long time before you fall flat on your face. But seriously, because your expenses will be so low from the get-go, you really will have a lot more time to let your restaurant actually have a chance to get some legs. And it's true, there are hundreds if not thousands of gringos with marginal restaurants that just kind of chug along. And of course, if they'd have been up in the States, they'd have closed down in a month. But down here, just a handful of clients trickling in every day just might be enough to pay your expenses. And you know, in the restaurant business, hope does spring eternal. So many restaurant owners who aren't actually operating in the red, but pretty close to it, will keep whipping that dead horse for sometimes years. It turns out, a lot of gringos never actually paid themselves a salary, simply because they couldn't. And so many of these guys don't close up shop because they've got some outside source of income like a pension or Social Security coming from the States to help them get by. So in the end, after a few years, that restaurant becomes just something to do, kind of a hangout or a hobby for them. And after a while, they blend in with the neighbors and the local social scene, and they still have a pretty nice retirement going. Now, these small mom-and-pop restaurants that are barely breaking even are a dime a dozen in places like Costa Rica, Panama, Cancun, Playa del Carmen, and anywhere on the tourist trail. And believe it or not, here's what often happens. Many times a fresh, green, starry-eyed gringo couple will walk into a place like that, fall in love with it, they'll pop in and out a few more times, and express some interest in buying it if, by chance, it's for sale. And those words are often music to the ears of the present owners. since in actuality, their retirement or semi-retirement has turned into a lot more work than they ever bargained for at little or no pay. In fact, I know a couple just like that who own a nice little restaurant in Copan, Honduras. And though they love their little restaurant and the town and the neighbors, one day the owner, a nice old guy from San Francisco, told me, "Johnny, you know, one day I sat down and figured out just how much I make an hour in this place. And in the 8 years that I've owned it, I reckon I average about $2 an hour." Because like he said, anyone who owns a mom-and-pop restaurant knows that it's normal to put in more than 80 hours a week. So what I'm saying is, watch out. Looks are deceiving. If someday you're in a so-called tropical paradise and you stumble into a mom-and-pop restaurant, and in your retirement fantasy you absolutely fall in love with the place, well, make sure you have a very, very good look at the books. And by the way, a lot of these mom-and-pop restaurants do not keep very good books at all. And to find out the real story on how the place is doing, you not only have to look at the books and talk to their accountant, it's also a really good idea to go down to their bank and check out their deposit records for at least the last half a year. Be very careful because things down here are done very informally. And accounting books and records easily doctored. And here's another problem. Turns out that often, even if the numbers don't jive and the books don't look right, when you fall in love with a place like that, you've often got unrealistic expectations yourself. So don't ever think that you and your partner or your husband are going to suddenly breathe brand new life into a place that's been virtually in a coma for the last few years. Because if you walked in and were enchanted by the place, then you have to ask yourself, why isn't this place really kicking out the cash? You have to wonder if for you it was love at first sight. Why hasn't the place caught on with everyone else? Remember, just because you paint the place, put up a new sign, add a few entrees to the menu, and buy a $1,000 Italian espresso machine, those kind of changes are unlikely to bring in any more new customers. But you know, hope springs eternal, and we've all been through that. And I'll be talking a bit more about buying an existing business on the next show, so stay tuned. Oh, and just one more thing before we finish here. People are asking how they can do a Skype or a phone consultation with me. You know, since every expat and expat wannabe's got its own personal set of circumstances. And during those conversations, we can be very specific. Now, in the last year, I've done quite a few of those calls, which means a lot of people who listen to this show are making plans to come down here permanently. Anyway, if you have some particular circumstance you want to talk about with me, just go to the Expat Wisdom website and click on the consult link, and we'll work out a time and get it done.
South of the border, down Mexico way.
You've been listening to The Expat Files, Living in Latin America, coming to you each week from somewhere south of the border. And don't forget, you can email me on anything at all about Latin America, theexpatfiles@gmail.com. See you next time. Nos vemos.
She was a picture.